This is Greater LA on KCRW, the show that connects you to the people and places of Southern California. Hey there, I'm Steve Chiatakis. Let's dance. The dance floor is hot tonight in Santa Monica. The DJ is spinning Rain on Me by Lady Gaga, and the crowd is going wild. It's Saturday night, and we've arrived at the hottest party for teens during this Pride Month.
You know, it's prom. It's prom. Exactly.
We are at Queer Prom 2022. The theme is Alice in Wonderland, but anyone can wear whatever they want. Yes. Because we are all about making yourself feel comfortable and making others feel comfortable.
That's Morgan Lynn and Alaya, students from Santa Monica High, and two of dozens of queer youth and young adults here tonight. They are here for one of the quintessential high school experiences. But as KCRW's Danielle Chiraguayo explains, this is not the prom from 16 Candles or Napoleon Dynamite. It is a prom made just for them.
In some ways, queer prom is a lot like regular prom. Teens running and screaming into hugs, giggling, crowning royalty.
And our second prom queen is Lucy Valancourt.
The lights are cool, and the people here are awesome. I had nothing to do this summer, so why not come? Also, it's a great way to meet, like, new people and just put myself out there.
That's Alaya. She just wrapped up her freshman year at Santa Monica High School and wasn't comfortable sharing her last name. This year's prom theme is Alice in Wonderland, and wherever you turn, you're thrust down the rabbit hole into the Mad Hatter's world. Cheshire Cats and Queen of Hearts posters, the dance floor, or what the Queer Prom Committee calls the Enchanted Glow Forest, is a magical place where the trees that line the space are engulfed in twinkle lights and neon-colored mushrooms. And there are queer pride flags everywhere. The asexual flag, the lesbian flag, the trans flag, the progress flag. This whole queer shindig is the brainchild of recently graduated high school senior Leo Patel and the Santa Monica High Gender and Sexuality Alliance.
We voted on it in the GSA. It was unanimous for Alice in Wonderland because we wanted to do, like, cool colors and, like, mushrooms. I really wanted fluorescent lights and, like, fluorescent paint. The most fun part of this for me is seeing everyone's outfits. Like, it's just, you know, I just find it so cool that everybody dresses up.
Oh, the outfits. It's a prom, so of course you had the usual tuxedos and suits, the teal and pink dresses, but others took fashion to the next level.
We're going pretty trad goth today, like kind of 80s heavy on the makeup.
I got these black high-heel boots. They're like 6-inch, I think. I love high heels so much. Oh, my God. I got the black skinny jeans, a staple of the gay twink culture. Anyway.
My dad today gave me that long jacket with like the red lining because he said it was too small for him.
And my knee-high Converse, which I absolutely adore. I wear those everywhere.
But the core of tonight's queer prom isn't the flashy outfits or the catered Mexican food or the royal court. It's the feelings bubbling just beneath the surface. Morgan Lind is a 17-year-old trans student at Claremont High School. They traveled all the way out to Santa Monica for queer prom.
Being in a place like this, being surrounded by people like me, it's like being able to not have that in the back of my mind. And also kind of being able to be like, oh my God, like, I feel like I'm friends with all these people already, you know? Like I could go up to these people, and I would have so much in common with them.
Well, I feel like a lot of people nowadays are like, well, why can't they just go to the normal prom? Like, it's California, you know? It's, like, not a big deal. And I feel like, yeah, like, at my prom, like, at my school especially, like, if you were homophobic, you'd be the one being bullied. You know what I mean? Which is great. But I feel like there's also this kind of environment where it's, like, people aren't judging you for being gay. They're judging you from being different.
That's Santa Monica High's GSA chair, Leo, again. He actually went to his high school's prom earlier this month. But it just wasn't the same.
I left early. Like, it was just not my scene. It felt very uncomfortable. Didn't feel comfortable dancing. Didn't feel comfortable, like, really going all out. Like, I didn't wear makeup or anything. And I don't feel like I can be, like, completely, like, my full self. And so it's just, like, here it's just, like, everybody kind of gets it, and everybody's just doing what they want.
It's that ability to bring your full self that drew 14-year-old Bo Ryan out tonight. This is a space where Bo feels like they can just breathe, and they can just exist.
As a trans person of color, also has, like, I have invisible disabilities, but I have kind of physical aspects that tend to flare up, like tics, and I stim a lot. And so, as growing up, even before you come out as queer, you learn to enter a room and err on the side of caution. And both of us are lucky enough to live in a state with a lot of, like, safe trans laws and safe queer laws. We're allowed to marry, and that is, we're very lucky, but that doesn't, like, you never unlearn that caution from a young age.
Queer proms in LA have a rich history. In 1994, LA Unified helped put one on at Fairfax High School. And according to the LA Times, it drew protesters from a local Baptist church who yelled anti-gay chants like "God made Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve." There was none of that prejudice at this year's queer prom, and none of that hate. It was just a bunch of teens having fun, laughing, dancing, and being themselves. For KCRW, I'm Danielle Chiriguayo.
Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. The Supreme Court's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade set a new precedent in the United States. The dissenting justices wrote that it was the first time in its history the court had rescinded an individual right in its entirety and conferred it to the states. In his concurring opinion, Justice Clarence Thomas wrote that Supreme Court cases protecting gay marriage, gay sex, and contraception should also be reexamined. And that has many worry that other rights could be next. UCLA Associate Dean Brad Sears was the founding director of the Williams Institute there, which is a think tank on gender identity and sexual orientation. And he joins us right now. Thank you so much, Brad, for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
There has been this concern about marriage equality ever since the justices ruled in the Obergefell case in 2015. Donald Trump gets elected president the following year, and the possibility for more conservative justices on the high court, which caused even more concern. How tenuous was that decision, do you think, to begin with?
To begin with, not that tenuous. It was a great opinion by Justice Kennedy in line of several opinions of his going back to the late 1990s, supporting LGBTQ rights with a solid Supreme Court majority. What we've seen since that opinion is kind of a radical remaking of the federal judiciary, including the composition of the Supreme Court. And I think the opinion that was issued on Friday really erodes the kind of reasoning of the Obergefell opinion.
Do you think it's just a matter of time before this court undoes that guaranteed right as well? I mean, how concerned were you with the concurring opinion that, Justice Clarence Thomas came out with on the day of the ruling last week?
Well, that's nothing new from Justice Thomas. There were four justices that dissented in Obergefell. So I think we've always not had some of these justices. I think what has changed is the boldness of this new majority on the Supreme Court to really overturn precedent, well-established precedent like Roe versus Wade, and quite swiftly chart a new direction. And so I think what we might have expected is a narrowing or whittling down of the Obergefell decision over time. Now is at risk, I would say, for a more rapid reversal. I do want to caution that the risk is there, but the majority of the opinion also goes out of its way to say that it is limiting its decision to abortion, and there are still a number of arguments to be made to distinguish Obergefell from Roe versus Wade and Casey.
Justice Brett Kavanaugh did write in his opinion that, quote, overruling Roe does not threaten or cast doubt on those other precedents. I mean, we're talking gay marriage, but also, as I mentioned, we're talking at the top, I mentioned gay sex and contraception as well. Does what he wrote, Justice Kavanaugh wrote, make sense? And does it give you any confidence going forward?
Yeah, I mean, like I said, the majority opinion of some justices say, hey, this is just limited to abortion because with abortion, we have this unique interest in protecting fetal life. The problem with that is that the reasoning that they're using, if you applied the same reasoning to same-sex marriage, you would not reach a conclusion that there's a right to marriage that extends to same-sex couples. And what the court is now has a majority alignment around is that in this part of constitutional analysis, we care more about what legislators or the people who wrote the Constitution thought in 1780 or 1880 than what people today think about these principles in our Constitution or the impact of overturning a decision. And I think if you go back to 1780 or 1880 and look for an understanding that anything in the Constitution by the people who were drafting amendments or the Constitution at those times dealt with same-sex marriage, you could not find it. And so that is what's making the right to marry so tenuous at this point.
Are there any cases, Brad, moving through the court system now that could potentially provide the Supreme Court with the opportunity to undo Obergefell going forward?
There's nothing right now. And so I mentioned earlier what we might have expected is a more incremental chipping away of the right to marry. And that would have been through an increasing accommodation of people's individual religious beliefs and saying because of their religious beliefs, they don't have to recognize as individuals or maybe even in their government or public roles the right to marry. There have been some cases where same-sex couples, for example, who are state employees were treated differently than different sex married employees rejected to date, but we might see that changing. And so what we might have expected to date is kind of the development of a second class or second tier marriage for same-sex couples. I think what the decision on Friday points to is a more wholesale overturning. To do that, a state legislature would have to once again prohibit marriage same-sex couples in its state. Let me say this on the other side too, is that there are arguments that would distinguish marriage from abortion. Really, when you consider about whether to overturn a precedent, the court on Friday went out of the way to say, hey, people really aren't relying on the right to abortion. Now, there's arguments against that, but they said these are pregnancies that are accidental or not wanted, and therefore no one is kind of relying on abortion. It's kind of the opposite of that. This is something that's unplanned. If there's anything about marriage in most cases is that it is planned and people do rely on it. Couples begin to rely on each other financially. They have kids, so there's relationships with children and other relatives based on marriage. And when you think about mortgages or loans or public benefits, whether you're married or not is taken into account in all those financial transactions. So I think there are some arguments that are pretty strong to distinguish overturning Obergefell and marriages of hundreds of thousands of couples out there versus overturning the right to abortion.
Before we let you go, Brad, what about contraception? We haven't talked about that. The Supreme Court did affirm the right for Americans to use contraception dating back to 1965. I mean, does that one seem safe to you, given what Justice Clarence Thomas said?
I would say looking at the things that Thomas is listing off, contraception seems on shakier grounds than marriage. I think some of those reliance issues, as I just described, are even less present in terms of contraception. And this court does seem to be very concerned about an interest in fetal life is what they're calling it. There is another argument, though, that runs through these cases and that Justice Kennedy, at least in the Lawrence case that dealt with sodomy laws and Obergefell that dealt with marriage, made sure to emphasize this wasn't only about privacy and liberty. it was also about equality under the law. And there's a significant equality interest for LGBTQ people in being free of criminal prosecution and having the right to marry. And so I think that's another distinguishing argument that's left for the LGBTQ rights cases.
Brad Sears, Associate Dean of Public Interest Law over at UCLA. Brad, thanks for coming on and talking to us today about it.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Coming up, when you see it, you know what it serves. The hot dog stand that stood for decades is back for you to relish. That's yours when we're back on KCRW's Greater LA. Onward now with Greater LA on KCRW. I'm Steve Chiotakis. It is an iconic LA hot dog stand. It's getting ready to make its return in West Hollywood. The 75-year-old Tale of the Pup closed back in 2005. Well, now it's getting set to reopen again for all hot dog lovers to enjoy, thanks to a group that helped renovate and restore other iconic L.A. spots like the Highland Park Bowl. Bobby Green is one of the co-owners and lead designers of the group called the 1933 Group, and he joins us right now. Hey, Bobby.
Steve, thanks for having me on.
This is an iconic L.A. hot dog stand. A lot of folks don't know what it is because it's been gone for so long. So describe what Tale of the Pup is. Tell us more about the history.
Well, it's pretty simple on the surface of it. I mean, it's just a giant hot dog. And at the time it was built, 1946, it was kind of near the tail end of the architectural movement known as programmatic architecture, or sometimes called vernacular architecture. And that type of architecture, you know, was birthed by the automobile. It's a fascinating story. You know, some people look at these silly little buildings in old pictures and think, oh, what a funny thing that was. But, you know, at the time, it was quite a engineering feat and also quite a standout piece. And really, you know, Los Angeles was the epicenter for this style of architecture. And I think it was because we had the film industry. So we kind of had this crazy can build anything kind of attitude as Angelenos in the 1920s, that it was just natural to build, you know, whatever, a giant hat like the Derby, giant bulldog or giant barrel, and they're fascinating.
You've done other renovations as well across LA. So what was it like with something like this, which has a lot of history that a lot of people remember? And yet, you know, you don't want to mess this up.
Oh, I mean, the pressure is immense, you know. And to be honest, I pressure myself more than even you know, fans of Tale of the Pup. Because to me, this is so important. And of course, every restoration I do is so important. And Tale of the Pup was more influential because it's something you could see. Even if you didn't ever get a hot dog, let's say your entire life, you knew Tale of the Pup, you would turn the corner and see the building, and it would make you smile or laugh.
Is everything going to be exactly as it was in 1946 when it opened? I mean, what kind of detail have you guys done?
Well, you know, like I do with any project, I do a deep dive into the history of it. And one thing amazing about Tale of the Pup, as with the Formosa, was that it was open for so many decades. And you had different owners, and each owner would bring their own flavor to the place. So when it first opened in 1946, it was owned by celebrities. Frank and Yolanda, they were these famous ballroom dancers. They were on TV a lot. And so they ended up having a couple kids, and they didn't really work so much. They just decided to open this Tale of the Pup. So, you know, the night it opened, star-studded event, searchlights, the press was there. You know, it opened with a bang. And they had their menu, and they had their way of making things. And then later on, you know, I interviewed chefs that had worked at the Pup in the 1950s, in the 70s, in the 80s, 90s. And as different owners would come in, we had, you know, Eddie and Dennis Blake took over in the early 70s, and they kind of made their own menu, their own style. So what I did was kind of look at the best of all the decades, and that's how we kind of crafted the menu around, you know, things they had in 1946, things they had in 1970, 80, as well as things we're going to have in, you know, 2022, because people want different things now.
Is it going to be in the same spot, Bobby, as it was before? I mean, is it, you know, does it have wheels? Is it like the Wienermobile or?
Sometimes I wish it was. I could just drive it around town. Location was a major thing for me, because if you think about it, we acquired this thing in 2018. And the reason it's taken this long was because I wanted the perfect location, and I wanted it as close to the original location as possible. It was next to the Beverly Center on La Cienega, but I wanted it as close to La Cienega Beverly as possible. So luckily, finally, we found an incredible location, La Cienega and Santa Monica Boulevard. So we're only a couple major streets up.
I know a lot of folks are excited about this thing opening up. So when do we get the debut dog?
Well, one date that we're looking at right now is actually National Hot Dog Day, which is July 20th. So we might do a few little, you know, practice soft openings before that. But I think we're going to try to do our grand opening July 20th.
National Hot Dog Day, because, you know, there's a hamburger day, right? There's a day for donut day. So, of course, we have a National Hot Dog Day, right?
Absolutely. Well, interesting fact, Steve, did you know that Los Angeles consumes more hot dogs per year than any other city in America?
I did not know that. Bobby Green of the 1933 Group, co-owner and lead designer of the new Tale of the Pup. Good luck to you, Bobby. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for your great work in Los Angeles.
And it turns out Bobby is right. We had to fact check. According to the National Hot Dog and Sausage Council, yes, there is such a group. L.A. tops the list of hot dog consuming cities of 2021, with New York City a close second. We are here for that kind of tubular information. That is it for us this evening. Tomorrow, L.A.'s brand new professional women's soccer team is having some success on the field, but they're having even more success in the stands. That's on tomorrow's GLA. Visit us, by the way, anytime at kcrw.com/greaterLA. Tell us how you're doing. Share some story ideas with us. Subscribe to the podcast, too, all at the website, kcrw.com/GLA. Jenna Cagle, Juliana Mayo, Rebecca Ludman, Phil Richards, Danielle Chiriguayo, Holly Adams, and Christian Bordahl all had hands on this evening's episode. I'm Steve Chitakis. Thanks for your time and for those ears. Have a great night.